sprinting towards this goal. I'd be amazed if we're really looking at North Korean denuclearization by the end of the year, something like that.
A South Korea-North Korea presidential summit is scheduled for April 27th. It's Friday, March 30th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Remember, you're a part of our program. Join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai returns to Pakistan. A Vietnamese singer stands for free expression. And would you live in a city of 100 million people? Find out on today's VOA Asia. Thanks for being with us. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in will hold a bilateral summit on April 27th. Ri Song-kwon, the chairman of North Korea's Committee for the Peaceful Reunification of the Country, announced that date Thursday at a news conference after a meeting between envoys from both Koreas in the border village of Panmunjom. He said, in the talks, both sides discussed issues regarding the North Korea-South Korea summit and agreed on the following. First, North Korea and South Korea will carry out both leaders' decisions and hold the summit on 27 April 2018 at Peace House, located on the South Korean side of Panmunjom. South Korean Unification Minister Cho Myung-kyung said Thursday that North and South Korean envoys we'll meet again next Wednesday, April 4th, to finalize the details for the Kim Moon summit. He said South and North Korea will hold working-level talks on April 4th to discuss formality, security, and press coverage on the South Korean side of Panmunjom. Both sides agree to decide on the date and venue of working-level talks regarding the communication line between South and North Korea. The leaders of North and South Korea have met just twice since the nation was divided, the first time in 2000 and the last time in 2007. The agreement on the inter-Korean summit was reached just days after Kim Jong-un made a surprise visit to China this week for meetings with Chinese President Xi Jinping. The summit comes after a year of increased tensions between Pyongyang and Seoul over the North's defiant testing of its nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs, and an exchange of bellicose rhetoric between the North and U.S. President Donald Trump. Robert Kelly is a political analyst on inter-Korean affairs and an associate professor in political science at Pusan National University. He says he remains skeptical that a proposed summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un will result in concrete changes in North Korea's nuclear program.
You know, more realistically is that the president goes in there and actually, you know, restarts really serious negotiations. Not that the summit is sort of the end of everything, but that the summit kind of ignites a process that has been frozen in place for 10 years, right? Sort of Trump and Kim sort of break the ice, get things moving, break up the logjam, and then you get into really serious negotiations that actually end this. I mean, we've gone through two sets of negotiations, one in the 90s and one in the 2000s, the agreed framework and the six-party talks, and they both kind of faltered in the end. And, you know, maybe Trump and Kim can reverse the process, have a summit that kind of like radically forces things forward, and, you know, and then in a couple of years we'll have a final deal.
Senior U.S. officials have expressed concerns privately, that is, that South Korea is a weak link in the U.S. alliance between South Korea and Japan and could be too quick to seal a deal with North Korea. Thursday afternoon, President Trump threatened to hold up a trade agreement reached this week with South Korea until after a deal is reached with North Korea on denuclearization. In a speech in Ohio, Trump said he doesn't want to give up what he called a very strong card in negotiations with South Korea.
And I may hold it up till after a deal is made with North Korea. Does everybody understand that? You know why, right? You know why? Because it's a very strong card. And I want to make sure everyone is treated fairly, and we're moving along very nicely with North Korea. We'll see what happens.
The United States and South Korea have agreed to revise their six-year-old trade pact with a side deal to deter competitive currency devaluation by Seoul and with concessions for U.S. autos and pharmaceutical companies, Trump administration officials said on Tuesday. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. North Korean defectors worry nuclear deal will overlook atrocities. Report: Japan offers North Korea summit, Pyongyang discussing it. Activist Malala makes emotional return to native Pakistan. China's Communist Party tightens grip on media, message. And Chinese pill factories fuel opioid crisis in America's heartland. Expanded coverage of these stories, that is, and more, is on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. I'm David Byrd in Washington, and VOA Asia continues. Nobel laureate Malala Yousafzai returned Thursday to her native Pakistan nearly 6 years after she was shot by Islamic militants in her northwestern home district of Swat for advocating female education. Malala was 14 and already an advocate for girls' education in October 2012, when masked gunmen intercepted her school van and shot her in the head. My colleague Sarah Williams spoke with Ayaz Gul in Islamabad about Malala's surprise homecoming.
People in Pakistan were unaware of this trip until 24 hours ago, and it is obvious that for security reasons, her visit and other activities were kept confidential by the authorities. But then she landed early in the morning on Thursday in Islamabad. And then shortly afterwards, she met Prime Minister Shahid Khaqan Abbasi, where a big event especially was organized to welcome her.
And she apparently also gave a speech.
Yes, that big gathering in the Prime Minister's office was basically, there were lawmakers, government officials, civil society activists, and young students. And that's where Malala spoke. And, you know, the moment she started her speech, she got emotional and she broke down into tears. So after having gone through this difficult time and returning to her homeland and standing in front of her home audience, the moment she started her speech, she started crying. And then she said that she could not believe that she is finally standing back on her homeland, on home soil. And, you know, she was really thankful to the government. And then, obviously, as we know, that globally she has been campaigning for female education to empower women. And that's what she used the occasion for and emphasized the need for the government and activists in Pakistan to do more for promoting female education that she has been championing.
Ayaz Gul reporting from Islamabad. Malala has been living in Britain since going there for emergency surgery. She is currently a student at Oxford University, studying in that school's philosophy, politics, and economics program. We're happy you're with us on this Friday morning. I'm David Byrd in Washington. She's talked shop with former President Barack Obama and is soon to be the subject of a featured documentary. Mai Khoi is an outspoken musician who has become a thorn in the side of the Vietnamese government. She was detained Tuesday after refusing to shut up about human rights in the midst of a widening crackdown on dissent in that country. David Boyle reports from Hanoi.
These sculptures, made by men waiting to die in prison, were the prelude to a risky underground album launch late last month. When Mai Khoi has performed live shows in the past, her politically charged compositions have attracted uninvited guests from state security. That pressure, though, has only strengthened her resolve to raise sensitive topics, like the cases of the death row convicts who crafted these sculptures.
Most of the people in Vietnam have been brainwashed. It's very difficult to change that, but we still all our best. We have music. Music can go very far and can make people feel something.
Khoi, who first shot to popularity as a state-ordained pop star in 2010, knows how to court media attention. but her choice to transition into an outspoken human rights advocate is a precarious move in Vietnam. Police have shut down several of her shows, like this one in 2017. On Tuesday, she was detained at Hanoi's Noi Bai Airport and held for 8 hours. The Vietnamese government has, however, previously denied ever barring her from performing. Meanwhile, they have orchestrated a sweeping state crackdown on dissent that has seen hefty jail sentences meted out to activists across the country. David Boyle for VOA News, Hanoi.
Coming up, will you live in a city of 100 million people? Find out. You're listening to VOA Asia. Right now, Shanghai, China ranks as the world's largest city based on population, with more than 24 million people. Beijing is a close second. But we could see the world's first 100 million population city by the end of the century. As Henry Ridgewell reports, even small cities could balloon into huge metropolises in the coming decades.
By the end of the century, the world's population is forecast to reach up to 14 billion. 80% of those people will be living in cities, according to the new research.
We're now seeing the urbanization wave heading through China. That's toward the latter part of its urbanization, and now it's headed for India. And then we'll see it culminate in the big cities of sub-Saharan Africa.
That could mean the first 100 million city. The top candidate is Lagos, Nigeria. Today, its population is 20 million. Not the biggest, half the size of Tokyo, but one of the fastest growing. In two generations, Lagos has grown 100-fold. By 2100, it is projected to be home to more people than the whole of California.
Lagos, Dar es Salaam, Kinshasa, these are the cities that are looking at 4 to 5-fold increases in population. By the end of the century, the lion's share of large cities will be, you know, the top 20, if you will. Most of those will be in Africa.
Lagos sprawls across 1,000 square kilometres, an urban jungle of skyscrapers, shanty towns, and everything in between. Its population grows by 900 people per day. The poorest residents, often migrant communities, live in slums by the lagoon. Amnesty International has warned of ruthless forced evictions to make way for new developments, which they claim have left more than 30,000 people homeless and 11 dead.
The threat of being evicted, the threat of being chased away overnight, has grabbed people to the extent that they cannot even walk, operate or do anything in this area.
Across Africa, the median age is under 20. The fertility rate is 4.4 births, and Africans are becoming increasingly urban. Even small cities are forecast to balloon in size. Niamey in Niger could grow from under 1 million today to 46 million by the end of the century. Blantyre in Malawi from 1 to 40 million. Asia too will witness huge urban growth. Kabul, Afghanistan, is projected to hit 50 million people. Despite the associated problems of slums, poor sanitation and pollution, Hornweg says increasing urbanization can be a good thing.
Cities, by their nature, because of our more compact lifestyle, can provide a quality of life higher than anywhere else with less energy per unit of GDP. So cities actually provide a really important opportunity. We won't get to global sustainability without big cities.
Many cities in the West are predicted to plateau or decline in size. By the end of the century, only 14 of the biggest 100 are forecast to be in North America or Europe. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and on SoundCloud. Download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. You can find us at voanews.com. Let us hear from you, VOA Asia Facebook, or email us at voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy your day.